As you can see from the long list of authors, this was a very collaborative project. Originally, it was done by David Bright, a graduate student who was advised from the University of Florida, but was located in Lincoln, Nebraska, with myself and several other colleagues. And our research focus in our lab there has been looking at antimicrobials, antibiotic resistance in heavily impacted, manured environments. So I think this slide here, I kind of adapted it from another publication, really helps focus the research, a complicated research field. Makes it a little more simple to understand where things are located and what sort of questions we're asking. So we know that over here on the far right is the reason why we're studying in this field. We're getting increased resistance in infections in humans. Antibiotic resistance is going up, and it's going up particularly in pathogens. The way we look at it now is we know that humans use a lot of antibiotics and animals use a lot of antibiotics. It looks like the ratio of antibiotic use is about 4 times higher in agriculture. So certainly there is a perception that there's a strong pressure of antibiotic use to affect this whole system. But we also have to realize that human use as well also affects both in the excretion of antibiotic residuals, increased resistance of non-pathogens, either excreted directly or affected by the residuals in the environment. And then, of course, there's this really interesting field looking at horizontal gene transfer, where some of these genes may be jumping into resistant pathogens that then are closer to humans and can infect the humans. So, you know, these arrows are interesting to think about and contemplate, well, how big is this arrow? How small is this arrow? I think as a field, we'll probably get a lot more confident idea about this in the next 10 years or so. There's certainly a lot of research going on. But I think the important part is you got to focus on one little part of this to try and really make some headway in this area. So our approach has been simply because we are in Nebraska. We're able to get close to into these animal feeding operations and take a look at what's happening in antibiotics and antibiotic resistance. So there's reasons why we do feed antibiotics to animals, certainly to prevent disease. There is some feeding for disease prevention. And then growth promotion, of course, is also something that's been done in the past. And as a society, I think we're starting to move away from that. Administration can be on the herd or the individual level. There's shorter long-term treatment. There's also multiple routes that the treatment can occur. Low dose is what we're really worried about. This low dose treatment for growth promotion, a lot of folks really worry about that slowly increasing the natural or background level of antibiotic resistance in animals and in these production environments and eventually in the fields where the manure is applied. So that's something that the industry is really focusing on to control better. There is quite a bit of research going on, particularly in the routes of antibiotic administration to animals and best ways to administer these things. So I think we are moving in the right direction, but there is a lot of work to be done. Some of the ongoing policies involve generally some antibiotics are used for humans while others are more used for animals. That's a pretty sound one where if you want to try and keep the last resort antimicrobials available for human infections, it's better not to be feeding that in large doses to the animals around us. Other recent changes have been the U.S. Veterinary Feed Directive that seeks to curb some of this antibiotic feed low dose for growth promotion. Basically, any sort of antibiotic now that comes into the farm must be prescribed by a veterinarian. So it's a good step in the right direction. I think we can make more steps in that direction. Going back to this initial idea and focus of where can I make a contribution, where did David, the student, help to make a contribution, it's really looking at this antibiotic use in agricultural systems. And the way we did it in the study, we weren't separating out between pathogenic natural members in the manure community. We were looking at the whole soil microbial community and the effect on residuals and antibiotic resistance. So the study rationale and objectives, we wanted to more easily see the relationships between these antibiotic resistance genes, the residual antibiotics that were excreted, and we think that maybe looking at some of these really highly impacted environments, we can start to see some of these relationships a little bit easier than in some other natural systems where antibiotic levels are much lower. So one of the questions, or a series of list of questions there, is one is in samples where the antibiotic resistance gene is greater, do we also see greater levels of the residual antibiotic? Is there a relationship between those two? Does it change, increase, decrease with time? And what are the myriad environmental factors that may be trending with these two groups together or separately? So our approach was an ongoing study that was being conducted at the Meat Animal Research Center. And it was looking at just the effects of two different cattle diets. One was a standard corn-based diet that was fed pretty regularly for the past 50 years to animals. Another one is where a diet where part of the corn was substituted with wet distillers grains plus solubles. That's the material that's left over after you have ethanol production, and the best way for them to move that out of from a waste stream and into something valuable is to feed it to the animals. It's enriched in nutrients. It has kind of a lower starch content because you're taking that starch and converting it to ethanol. There are also some other issues with how it's produced and maybe how it's been produced in the past that I'll come back to and talk a little bit about. But basically, just think of corn with all the easily accessible starch pulled out of it. So this study in the Clay Center was looking at a lot of different environmental issues associated with feeding this. They were looking at gas emissions and also effects on soil quality, manure quality, things like that. The basic study was set up with 5 replicate pens per diet treatment, and 12 sites were selected in each pen based upon a conductance, electrical conductance survey. So one of the questions that we have in doing some of this environmental work at a cattle feedlot is it's, the environment is very patchy, it changes from spot to spot. So the question is, how do you best sample a pen and get representative material from that pen? So one approach is to use a survey that takes all the different conductance data from that pen and then has you sample across that whole spectrum. Soils were collected before starting the diet. Animals had been in these pens for years and years and years beforehand. They go through a process of cleaning the pens roughly every year to 2 years as the animals come in and out of the pen. So we did an extensive sampling before the study diet study was started, and then after a little more than a year after the diet treatments were implemented. There was a suite of analyses for soil parameters, and some of the folks that were listed as co-authors were responsible for those. Lots and lots of things were measured. Luckily for us, soil samples were frozen for subsequent analysis. And so knowing that this nice data set of samples existed, we thought we could maybe tackle some of these questions about antibiotic resistance, resistant antimicrobials, and whether the relationships between those. So we focused on mainly looking at TET resistance genes, and for the residuals, we did an extraction of LC-MS-MS to see what types of tetracycline residues were still around in the soil. And we also looked at monensin, which was fed to animals as an antimicrobial that increases weight gain during the entire period that they're fed. So, looking at the genes and this initial screen of samples, We can see that there was a wide diversity of genes detected, and their screened abundance, or you know how often we were able to detect them, really varied quite a bit. We decided to select three of these genes for further study, one that was widely distributed and others that were less widely distributed, and do a secondary screen on all samples. So this was just a subsample of the of 30 samples from that 240, just to kind of get a little taste of what was there. And in that larger sampling, we found very similar levels, although the abundance or the detection of TETQ and TETX did go up slightly. We also wanted to look at these three genes because they also had different resistance mechanisms. From that 240 samples, we then selected 50 samples that were positive for the AQ and X, and also did the extraction on those and quantification of resistance of residuals in those samples. We also did with those samples, we did a quantitative PCR to see what the numbers of those resistance genes were, and you can see, for instance, with TET-A, that initially, and this is on a log abundance, the amount of TET-A did not statistically go up, although with this the one diet, it did look like it increased a little bit, but it was not significant. With TET-Q and TET-X, there was a significant increase with time for both diets, but there was no difference between the two diets. Looking at the antibiotic residues, we saw a similar pattern, but instead of an increase, we saw a general decrease. So initially, the levels of these different tetracycline residues were quite high to begin with, but over time decreased, and there was generally not a difference between the two diets. Although if you look at comparing the control corn diet to the distillers grain diet, you can see that a lot of those numbers were numerically greater, and in the instance where total tetracycline was actually compared, it was statistically greater. There seems to be an effect of diet there with the residual tetracycline genes, or residual tetracycline residues, but the overall trend was for a decrease with time. Looking closer at, is there a relationship between the resistance genes and the amount of residual tetracyclines? Basically, no. This is a log-log scale. TET-A, there might be a slight increase, although there are a couple points there that seem to have a pretty high influence on the slope of that line. Statistics tells us that the slope was not significantly different from zero. Comparing it to Monensin, very similar result. Flat line across the log scale of residue content. So finally, moving into environmental factors, taking a look at, are there some common factors that affect both gene abundance and the residue abundance? You can look from this just kind of scanning across and see that tetracycline resistance genes seem to be responding to similar factors, temperature, ammonium hydrogen sulfide content, while the residues themselves respond to other factors like volatile solids, potassium, conductivity. So I think we can, and across the bottom there is the whole suite of different environmental factors that we look for correlations between. I think this together points to a couple of interesting ideas, in that there is a wide diversity of these genes, but the resistance genes and antibiotic residues are generally not related to one another in this system at the time points that we looked at. TET-A, there might have been some increase over time. But, and also with these different correlating environmental factors, I think there's different things that are affecting resistance genes and residue content. I think looking forward, realizing that these were just snapshots, I think it'd be interesting to take a look at some of these samples and divide them into samples that had high residue left in them and then lower residue, and then do an incubation study and see, does that residue eventually affect resistance genes, say, if we take the material and put it into a soil environment, which is what would normally happen if you take this manure out and put it in the soil. So I think there's some interesting things we can do. Going into the future, I would have liked to see maybe some more connections between resistance genes and residues, but it's also interesting to find that maybe these things are not as tightly connected as we think. So thank you very much, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy.
Thank you.
Yes. Right. Okay, so that first question, we do have access to the information, and I was just thinking about how I should have looked at that before I came up here. Right before I came up here. I know the Monensin use is ongoing, and it's in every diet that they feed out there, and it's a pretty standard thing for the industry to use. The tetracycline use, I was kind of puzzling over my head, and I can't recall. I think there was some tetracycline use before the study started, which would explain why tetracycline levels were so high initially and then went down over time. Yes. Yep. Related to that, there is some tetracycline that was being used in the production of distillers' grains at the time, because you want your yeast there producing lots of ethanol, but you don't want any bacteria getting in there and starting to consume your ethanol. So at the time the study was, the soil samples were collected, the industry was using tetracyclines to reduce bacteria in the production of the ethanol and distillers grains. It seems to be disconnected between tetracycline. It was there, we were measuring tetracycline anyhow, and the fact that Monensin is used quite broadly, we found in previous studies that it was a pretty good marker for wastewater that maybe had been applied and there was runoff. If we found Monensin, it was usually a pretty good marker for, oh, this came from a cattle feedlot. So that's, it was more of a, it was there and we were getting the information anyhow. So the question is why do we not see a tighter connection between residuals and the gene abundance?
That's a problem.
Yes. So one thing to think about is this particular environment is fairly dry. So what we're looking at is manure comes out of the animal, has these things in it, dries out, not much happens. Okay, occasionally it gets wet, some microbial activity goes on. But largely, these are pretty dry environments. So it could be that we're just looking at a snapshot of what has come out and not had a chance to really have an effect. Okay. So if you think about it, this might be more representative of what's in the gut of a cow as it comes out. So I was surprised that there wasn't a stronger correlation there. It may be that the system has also reached a sustainable kind of maximum. Here's the level of resistance that can easily be retained in the system based upon other environmental factors controlling that. Okay, so even if you dump in more tetracycline, it's at kind of this maximum level of resistance. I think it's important to compare these numbers to numbers, say, from nearby soil sites, lots of other locations, and say, based upon the impact of antibiotics, here's what we see resistance-wise. That may be a more meaningful comparison to make.
Thank you. That concludes.
Yep.